This is William Tincup, and you are listening to the Recruiting Daily Podcast. We're broadcasting from Insights, which is Ceridian/Dayforce's user conference. I say slash because Ceridian is being rebranded as Dayforce in January. The logo's up. The conference is absolutely fantastic. I've been to Insights probably 12 times, 15 times. This is the largest and best one I've seen. So I've got two guests on with me today, right now. And so we're going to get into their session that they had yesterday, and we're going to talk a little bit. So why don't we do introductions? Brittany, would you introduce yourself?
I would love to kick us off. My name is Brittany Schmaling, and I'm a principal data analyst at Dayforce.
A principal data analyst. What does that do? What would you say you do?
So I'm a researcher of people. My background is industrial organizational psychology. I work with the data from our clients who have signed a data processing addendum, giving me permission to do research on their de-identified data to make sure we're holding to privacy standards.
Right.
And I do different research studies like burnout or psychological safety.
Right. And does that data, can you aggregate it up?
Yeah. Okay, so I can break it down by industry. Break it down by pay type, gender, ethnicity, country.
Wow.
All sorts of fun things.
The cool thing is they have to sign off on it.
Correct.
Making sure that everybody's kosher with whatever you're going to run. And then 100%. You can then spit back to them some things that they might not be able to see about their own data.
Correct. Or I can build them dashboards in their product so they can go in and see it themselves.
Oh, I love that. Oh my God, I want that job.
I'm jealous. Fun one.
I'm very envious at this point. Steve, what about yourself?
Well, good morning. My name is Steve Knox. I actually lead the talent acquisition function here at Ceridian. So my team does all the hiring globally for the organization.
So 9,000 plus strong. So what type of hiring are we talking about? What scale?
We do about 2,500 to 3,000 hires per year, but that includes everything from early talent right through to the executive search.
My goodness.
All lines of business, all geographies where Ceridian operates.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So if you're hiring, let's say 3,000, how many candidates do you have for 3,000 hires?
We feel you probably go through to between 10 and 12,000
to
get to that number.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's even, we're using all the screening, all that stuff just to get to that point.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. That's a big number.
So, busy team.
Yeah. Busy team. Busy technology stack too. Well, why don't we talk about y'all's session yesterday? I heard it was fantastic. So why don't we just go into the session, act like the audience wasn't there because technically they weren't. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the session?
Yeah. So Steve and I talked about labor shortages and how to use data to combat your labor shortages. So with that, you've talked about external.
Uplifting topic. You were just kind of bring the count up was the idea.
Yeah. Well, we wanted something that was really relevant to our stakeholders.
Truth.
And in our executive survey that Dayforce recently ran, we found 66% of people had a labor shortage in the last year. And 88% of respondents said they were expected to have a labor shortage in the next 12 months.
Any industry stuff come out of that? Like, was specific industries have more or less on the labor shortage?
Great question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
My gut tells me that the hourly market was tougher in terms of shortage because at least what I see in Dallas is people just opt not to take the job in hourly. Whereas in professional, they've gotten to a certain point, they need a job. So I don't know if that holds true across all the data.
I think potentially too with the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
Finding workers who could work from home was a little bit easier versus having to find workers who had to go into the office and were fearful for their health to have to go in.
Well, you could use the world as your talent pool, right?
And that's exactly it now. It's completely opened up. It's a boundaryless, borderless world for recruiting, and you can hire talent, particularly if you're a remote first organization like Ceridian is. We can now hire anywhere in the world looking for that best talent.
Yeah. But I think that's key, though, if you're willing to open up and not require people to be in your office.
Right.
So there's a talk going on later today with some of our colleagues talking about what are some of those flexible work options. But I gave a case study example in our conversation of a fictitious client that wanted to hire 100 data scientists, but they wanted them on site 5 days a week. And they wanted them in a Midwest city.
Never gonna
happen. And how that limits your qualified, available, willing talent pool.
How do y'all both kind of understand not just the demand, but the supply? Like something like that to understand, okay, you want them to be in Wichita. Okay, totally get it. That's fine. How many of those people exist in Kansas or in the Midwest? And how many of them are in Wichita? How do you deal with the, and even with what you do, how do you deal with the supply side and the demand side?
Yeah, and that was exactly the crux of our conversation. So we did talk a little bit about, you know, this all starts with having access to your company's workforce plan and
right.
what is their hiring targets look like by geography, by line of business, what have you. And then to your point, William, how do you kind of lean in and do some of that research to understand what is the availability of talent in a respective market for the skills that you're looking for? What is that talent looking to be paid? Does your comp philosophy then align to that? Expectations from candidates? So all these factors come into play in terms of your ability to kind of compete for that war for talent and really win out.
I've historically struggled with workforce planning.
I think every company struggles with this. I think this is the common, you know, joke that everybody has is nobody has a really effective workforce plan. But, you know, sometimes you just start.
Who owns it?
Well, this is the other problem. There's no direct ownership. But
operations? You
know, I like to work with, let's at least start with what is our attrition rate and understanding what our replacement hiring is going to look like based on our FTE headcount.
Right.
And then approaching each line of business to say, now let's layer on what your net new hiring might look like. Add those two numbers together, and there, in effect, is a very basic workforce.
So if you do that with the line, do you have to get it validated with the CFO?
For sure, because usually the CFO is doing the headcount walk and the headcount planning aligned to the budget.
Okay, because they could say 100 engineers, but you go to the CFO and they say, actually,
there's
70.
No money for that. Exactly.
That's right. There's no money for that.
And really now, layering in the geographic issues, right? Like talent can be much cheaper in certain geographies versus others. So you can maybe get four heads for the price of one.
That's right. That's right. I like that. The interesting thing about flexibility is you see the trend of people wanting to return back to the office as if the office was great. Like this urge to go back to 2019 that was so awesome. And it's like you're forcing people to work in a way that they don't want to work and they're just not going to.
Yep.
Do y'all see the same thing in some of the data and some of the work that y'all do?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that came up in one of my sessions yesterday, too, was we're doing a lot of research on work energy.
Right.
And so that's one of the things that a takeaway for me is to write a research study specific to what is the work energy differences between remote employees and non-remote employees.
Take me into that real quick. Work energy, what is that? Because I always think of engagement as discretionary effort. So I translate when someone says engagement, I'm like, whatever, that's a made up term. So, but I think of, okay, you get an email, let's say at 5 o'clock on a Friday, you have a choice to either action that email, push that off, not do it, do it over the weekend, do it on Monday, right? So it's the discretionary effort is what a lot of companies are trying to unlock. They call it engagement, but for me, it's just discretionary effort. And that's probably different than energy.
Yeah. So when I talk about work energy, this came out of our burnout research. So Christina Maslach is a leading researcher on burnout, and burnout is defined as high in exhaustion, high in cynicism, and low in efficacy.
It's kind of pretty much defines me. My bad.
Within that different combination of high and low flags actually equates to five different categories of work energy. So disengagement, engaged, overextended, ineffective, and burned out. And so our work on burnout actually led us to measuring five different work energy categories.
Oh, I love that.
And that's where you'll see more work energy talk in the product. We started out with just what we called a burned out dashboard.
Right.
And now it's continuing to evolve.
Do you see a future where the employee can see where they're at?
I would 100%. I highly encourage any client who's currently looking at the data to show their employees, A, for transparency.
Yep.
I'm talking later today about psychological safety and how to build in your organization, and it validates the models. Some employees may not even know where they are on that work energy scale.
100%.
And so it gives them something to react to and to start that conversation with your leader or coworkers.
It's one thing for the company. I can see where the company needs to have that data and understand how to action it, especially if you're in a bad place. But if you're not in a bad place, it's also a great place for the company to remind you if you're not in a bad place, you know, some rewards and recognition or however we go about that. I know you deal with this with a lot of sourcers, recruiters, and how you deal with your team. How do you know their energy without looking at data or with looking at data? Some recruiters can handle 40 recs and not even think about it. It's like, and some people, you handle 40 recs and their heads explode.
Yep.
And you know this from your experience, yep. Right? So how do you kind of keep a finger on the pulse?
I mean, I'm a big believer in one of the first things I do when putting a team together is setting up a capacity model around recruiting. So I have a defined capacity model for my recruiters based on the type of roles that they recruit for.
Oh, that's cool.
Whether it's technical recruiting, corporate, yeah. or early talent. So really putting KPIs in place for them in terms of knowing how they will be measured.
Right.
And I think back to your earlier comments, I think we're going into a world now that's more about productivity and output.
Right.
Versus just putting in your hours and the
right.
time of day.
Right. Which is what we should be judged on, which was if there was a silver lining to COVID, it became more outcome centric and yep. less about how you got there, that just that you got there.
Yep.
But with a capacity model, I don't necessarily want you to disclose that, but I would love to actually know it personally.
talked about it in the session.
I do talk about it quite publicly. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well,
I mean, on average, my recruiters will handle no more than 15 requisitions.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Time. And this allows them to focus on, you know, building relationships with the candidates,
right.
the line managers they support, being a very supportive strategic advisor to the business. And what's important for me is delivering a world-class recruiting experience for the candidates, right?
Right.
And really making sure that we find their passion and purpose.
You let the technology do a lot of the automation.
Exactly.
Do the low value task, if you will.
Yep.
Let them do the more human task.
Exactly.
I love that. I love that a lot. And
I would say back to your earlier comments as well, I'm a big believer in the weekly check-in. I mean, checking in with your employees weekly, even if it's just for 5 minutes, and just asking, how are things going? How are you doing? How's the family? What did you do on the weekend? I mean, you really glean a lot of insight into how people are feeling.
I had a Fortune 20 CHRO tell me that. They're like, well, my favorite part of the job is I get to talk to my team. I'm like, do say that again real quick, just on air. Just I want to hear it one more time. They're like, I just enjoy talking to them. Like, it's not long talks. It's not like we're on the phone and all this stuff. It's just like, how are you doing? Is there anything you need? Is there anything you holding you back? How are you succeeding? You know, it's just basic stuff.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it every week, it becomes kind of normalized and people would expect it. And again, if there's a problem, you can deal with it.
Yep.
Talk about that in my psychological safety talk later today. I actually give the audience 7 questions to ask in their team meetings or in their one-on-ones to start building that conversation, because it's not normal in every organization.
Right.
But I'd love that you do that.
That's great.
Build that
not a lot of leaders do. That's actually really, really unique. You trust me, I talk to a lot of TA leaders. That's not normal. I'm not saying you're not normal. I came out wrong.
You're giving me a gold star.
No, okay. There you go.
You're giving me a gold star.
So labor shortage, back to what y'all did yesterday. Again, talking about it with your prospects and customers, everybody in the audience, I think is super important, but what's the fix? Like, what did y'all come to?
So some of my favorites that I talked about were some of the more innovative ways that Dayforce can help. And something people may not know is with Dayforce Wallet and on-demand pay, just offering that to employees, Sherm found you get 1.9 times more applicants per role.
I think it's actually really cool for him and his team.
Yeah.
Like, that's the first thing I'd say to a candidate, especially an hourly candidate. But I even think it creeps into a professional as well, is I'll just say earned wage access. Okay, yeah, we've kind of heard about that. You're taking an Uber, right? They tap out, they get their money. Yeah, you could do that.
Anyway.
Okay. Oh, by the way, it's free, which is totally unique to y'all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, absolutely unique. It's like, you get $100, it's your $100, done. There's not a fee for that. I think that is a fantastic recruiting tool, a benefit, if you will. So, yes.
It also reduces voluntary turnover
yep.
by 42%, even over roles that pay more in a base.
Why? I think that it's a great retention tool.
Yeah.
Right? So, once you've gotten them kind of used to that, you work at pick a company, and you're just used to that. And again, those emergencies happen, life happens, you need access to it, you don't need access to it, et cetera. It's kind of a safety net. You know it's there. If you need to use it, you use it. If you don't, you don't. How are you going to go to another company where you don't have that safety net?
Okay.
Even if it's a little bit more money. Why?
It also reduces some of the absenteeism related to financial stress by 62%. And so you'll see more of that research coming out from us in 2024. I'm calling it the benefit of benefits year.
Oh, nice.
I know I should go into marketing, right? But we're really focused on that financial wellness piece. So you'll be seeing a lot more research coming out on our Ceridian blog and other resources on that.
Again, it gets back to some of the things y'all done for historically or make life better, right?
It makes work life better.
So if we're talking about financial wellness, we're talking about wellness.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of going back. I mean, what's great about that is, again, you're doing what you're saying you're going to do. I mean, they have t-shirts over there that have this phrase on it. You've used that phrase for years. You're actually then fulfilling on that, doing research on that. So I think that's genius. So what are the things that we need to know about the labor shortage?
You know, one of the tips I give the business is really scaling back their expectations on qualifications. Like, you don't need to get all 10 requirements for the roles, and to really thoughtfully think about, is it okay to just hit 8 out of 10? And then can you train on the other missing competencies or skills that that candidate's lacking?
Right.
And can you upskill them? So that to me is really, you know, the foundation and the tip around how you deal with labor shortages. You don't need 10 out of 10. It's okay to get 8 and train on the rest and upskill and hire for potential and have somebody grow into the role rather than grow out of the role.
What's, because you're harvesting talent rather than plucking it off the vine. All right. React to this and tear this apart. Okay.
Oh, that sounds fun.
The best, yeah. the best way to work with a hiring manager. I've done this on stage, so it's already out there. The best way to work with a hiring manager is when they send you a job description, delete the email, and then open up a Google Doc, call them and say, what's the 3 most important things that you have to have with this role?
Yep.
Period.
Yep. Intake conversation with them.
Force them into a false construct of, there's just 3 things. Yeah, I know you had 12 things on the other document that I deleted, but what are the 3 things?
Yeah, and I think to your point, those 3 things are going to be the most critical things they're looking for.
Sure. Difference between important and critical. Yeah. Critical is a must-have. Everything else gets knocked out. Those are almost like knockout questions or knockout requirements. So that's how to work with hiring managers. Also, I've been on record of saying best way to work with candidates as a recruiter is to build the offer letter together. So you open up a Google Doc with the candidate and go, what's important to you?
Yep.
Let's just talk about it.
Yep.
And then you start making bullet points with them. And they're a part of the process, not a receiver of the process. They're actually a part of the process. It's like, what is important to you?
Yeah.
Let's just build it together.
Extremely innovative. I haven't heard that happening before.
That's what I do. Each and every day. No, I'm just, you know, some people reacted negatively to that because it's like, they have offer letters. They want to keep a structure to it. I'm like, yeah, but the candidate doesn't know that. The candidate doesn't know that you have some type of thing that's been through legal and all the other stuff. They care about having something that's personal to them. So,
and I think that is the big trend in recruiting now, a very personalized approach, and everybody has unique expectations on what they're looking for.
What are y'all seeing with, as it relates to speed? Because something I'm really curious about is the expectations that candidates have now in terms of responding. Like, you know, we're past the point of, should we respond to every candidate, right? It's almost like we're being judged by how fast we respond at what quality level that we respond to a candidate. Are y'all seeing that in the data or in practice?
100%. And I think that's always been the trend. And I think a lot of TA teams have always been focused on knowing that they usually fall short on communicating to candidates in a very timely and responsive manner. And I think to your point, candidates now with the advent of technology are expecting it to be in the moment updates on what's happening with the search, where they stand.
Yeah.
Texting is now huge in the recruiting journey, where you're constantly texting back and forth with candidates.
I think that's what I love about that. Again, we have to follow them around. Whatever their expectations that candidates are, it used to be, we're old enough to say, you could just kind of force a model on candidates and we just had to kind of go through your model, whatever the maze was. Now it's like, throw that out. They've now created a maze for us and we've got to go through that maze or we won't get the talent. Like, they judge us based on how we respond to them.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
They judge us based on the technology we use. Like, I've had candidates on record telling me, like, I can see in the URL what ATS they're using. I'm not going to apply. It's like, wow. Okay. All right. Okay. So
I think there's a big focus on self-serve as well. Our candidates want to be able to go in and see on their own where they are in the process and not always have to follow up with a recruiter as well. So there's that whole self-serve aspect.
Also. I love that. Designing their own kind of, I want to do a video interview or a live interview. I want to do texting or I don't want to use email. Like, why do we care? As long as the outcome, you know, as long as we meet the outcomes.
For sure.
All right. So what were the questions that you got during recession week-ish? You know, I have to not verbatim.
You're testing our memory here.
I know. we got one question, how are we measuring work energy?
Yeah.
I got a couple about how I've structured the TA function in terms of the capacity model that you referenced as well. I think that question came up. I got one other after the session too, just about branding and the importance of branding in this new world also.
Right.
And how critical knowing your company EDP is, and then how you translate that to the candidate market.
Right.
And I think to your point earlier that it needs to be a very personalized message because everybody's going to have a different trigger in terms of what they're looking for.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I think the employer brand, you have to live it. They have to feel it. So you can say one thing, but if they don't feel it on the other end, doesn't matter what you said.
Yeah. And I think the other trend is they don't want to hear about branding from the corporate marketing team, 100%. Right? There's no authenticity or genuineness. Or they want to hear it from employees
right.
that will tell them the honest goods about what it's like.
Yeah. Tear this apart, both of you. But I think the best recruiters that I've known personally are the ones that are advocates for the candidates. So they're almost not at odds with the organization, but they're almost, if they had to pick one, they're going to pick candidates. And they talk in very real terms and like, okay, yeah, that's unrealistic. Can't do that. You know, they talk normally. Those are my favorite recruiters, at least. How do you feel about that? First of all,
I 100% agree. I mean, my vision for my team is that we put the candidate experience at the core of all we do. And we remapped our process at Ceridian to make sure that it was a very candidate centric process in terms of delivering back to them. And at the end of the day, I think what's really enjoyable about the work you do in TA is the fact that you are helping people find their passion and purpose in life. And that's through the work that they do.
Right.
That there's no greater gift in terms of your worth than helping somebody find that next amazing opportunity or role.
We're not there yet. Oh, no, go ahead, Ben.
One of the things that I've really enjoyed about Insights is meeting other Dayforce employees in person for the first time. And they're like, oh, I heard my recruiter, the person who recruited me to Dayforce is here. They recruited me 10 years ago. And the love that they still have for that recruiter is so strong. They're like, I need to meet this person. I love this person.
Well, because they had a great experience.
Yeah.
You remember those great experiences. Hell, I stayed at a Four Seasons in Santiago, Chile in 2003. I can tell you every moment of that experience, literally. So, like, I get that.
That was 20 years ago.
It was 20 years ago. Yeah. I can tell you every part of that experience. And it was fantastic. I see a world at one point where the candidate can rate everything, you know, rate the hiring manager, rate the recruiter, rate the questions that they're being asked. Like, I see that level of transparency. We're not there yet. Either with technology or otherwise, maybe even emotionally, we're not ready to be, to have all that stuff. But I do believe that's coming.
I agree with you. And I think, you know, the challenge with that is it's going to put this undue pressure on middle management to make sure that they're really operating as the best they can be. And I think organizations are going to have to lean into properly training their managers to deal with that pressure of, you know, I'm going to be rated as the manager to work for or not, or the manager that I want to interview with.
Well, that's one of the things that we don't talk about as much is line managers. We call them hiring managers. In fact, I've called them hiring managers two or three times during the show, right? They're not trained in hiring. Like they have a job.
Yep.
And whatever that job is, they do that. And they're probably really exceptional at that.
Yep.
How do we get them to be exceptional, not recruiters, but how do we get them to be exceptional at asking and answering questions and things like that.
I think that's why you also see some progressive organizations have removed line managers from the hiring process. And they have the real experts who are good at hiring do the hiring and they assign those candidates to the line manager on their behalf. And I think that's a really progressive way to look at recruiting in this new role.
Yeah, because you don't have to let you go do your job.
Yep.
You need to focus
on your day job that we're paying you for. We know this person's an expert in recruiting and has the expertise to identify talent. And we're going to just place that talent with you.
I like that a lot. I like that a lot. Okay. So you said something about 2024 in terms of the research, the benefit of benefits.
Yeah.
What else you got going on for 24?
We have a workforce trends report. So you'll be able to see, add to the conversation of like the jobs reports, how many openings are there across the globe? How is that changing by industry? How's that changing by pay type? What can we add to that more economic conversation?
Right.
So that'll be coming out also on our marketing website. It'll be a free resource. We're also working on a public burnout tracker by industry.
I love that.
Across the globe.
Oh my God, I love that.
So that people can start benchmarking. They'll see what their work energy is on their dashboard in the product.
Right.
But how does that compare to the peers in my industry? And there won't be titles. It's all aggregated data. from over 1,000 or 1,500 clients globally.
I love that.
So that'll be there for people to look at. And then we're also, one of the things I'm most excited about is we're partnering with MIT and the Living Wage Institute. And we're creating a model for the U.S.
So some really dumb people. Got it. Yep.
That's why I'm so excited. I'm like, I can learn so much from you.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But we're creating a model to see what percentage of the U.S. workforce makes a living wage. And even if their base rate is that living wage.
Our government doesn't even know that.
Being given the hours.
Right.
So the partnership, Dayforce has the data to say, here's what you're being paid. Here's the hours you're working. And MIT has the model to say, this is what the living wage is in that county.
Oh,
we know because of taxation what county you live in.
Right.
So we're really, really excited about that partnership.
That is gorgeous.
So there will be a report coming out by the end of the year.
So two last questions. One is, you both work for an HR tech, work tech company. Is there any additional pressure of being a practitioner at a software company that serves practitioners? Do you have any pressure on you?
I don't see it as pressure, to be honest. I don't feel that pressure. I think it's quite interesting to work for a company where you use your own product in your day-to-day
100%.
Work. And so I've been in the recruiting space over 25 years, and
at the one point
I've never had this experience where I'm using my own product day in and day out.
You could complain about the other ones.
Yes,
you could.
And
can't complain
and what's great about it is I have an in to go to the product team directly when there's an enhancement or product efficiency that I'm looking for. And again, our product team is great and really willing to listen. So
we call them client zero. And some of our projects come out just because our internal team is like, this is a pain point for me. And we're like, if it's a pain point for you, it's a pain point for everyone else. Yeah. Let's prioritize this.
I love it. That was going to be my second question, was going to be, what's your relationship with the product team?
Very, very open, collaborative, engaging, for sure.
And I'm technically in product.
Oh,
so my role sits in our product organization.
Well, that's cool.
And I like to joke that I get the really cool experience of I'm an internal client of the product when I'm helping Steve develop dashboards for us to use.
Right.
But I'm also a designer of the product because I take everything I learn in the research studies and turn it back into how can we enhance the product.
Yeah. For the customers.
Yeah.
I love that. That is so fantastic. I know you are super busy, so thank you so much for carving out time for us, and thank you for coming on the show.
This has been fun. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right. And thanks for everyone listening. Until next time.